From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The U.S. needs Pakistan to be our ally in the war against terrorism, but the stability of Pakistan is at risk because of its vulnerable position geographically and the influence of Islamic extremists. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss Pakistan's past and present with journalist Owen Bennett Jones, author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. Also, we meet Brazilian songwriter Caetano Veloso, one of the founders of Tropicália, music that combines traditional Brazilian sounds with rock, pop, and jazz influences. His memoir has just been published in English, and he has a new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. officials say a ship intercepted in the Arabian Sea today has been found to be carrying about a dozen missiles and missile parts from North Korea. CNN and the Associated Press quoted the officials as saying the missiles were believed to be on their way to Yemen. They said the missiles were similar to the Scud missiles fired by Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. The official said the missiles did not appear to be on their way to Iraq. President Bush has made his second major economic appointment in 2 days, naming Wall Street veteran William Donaldson to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president has picked Donaldson to replace Harvey Pitt, who resigned the SEC post amid controversy last month. Pitt had been criticized for being too close to the accounting industry and for not doing enough to crack down on corporate fraud. Donaldson is highly regarded on Wall Street. He founded the investment bank Donaldson, Lufkin & Jenrett, and he's a former chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. He spoke after his nomination was announced by the president.
I am firmly committed to doing everything that I can do to restore the confidence of investors in the U.S. corporate and financial industry.
Donaldson added that corporate malfeasance, where proven, must be dealt with swiftly. His nomination must be confirmed by the Senate. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Weapons analysts from the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China are all reviewing their copies of the weapons declaration that Iraq turned in over the weekend. The UN's chief weapons inspector, Hans Blix, told reporters that his team hopes to have the main part of the document analyzed by Friday. A joint House-Senate Intelligence Committee has voted to approve a report on factors that led to the 9/11 terror attacks. Details of the report will remain classified, but tomorrow members are expected to disclose recommendations for improving intelligence gathering. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The panel's recommendations will include a call for a director of national intelligence. CIA Director George Tenet is the titular head of the intelligence community, but some say his position lacks the power to oversee the Defense Department, which controls the bulk of the intelligence budget. In fact, some members of Congress blame Tenet for the lack of coordination that preceded the attacks. While some members believe the new cabinet-level intelligence chief will fix the problem, others want more. They want to create a new domestic intelligence gathering agency to coordinate information on terror threats. But the panel is likely to recommend only a study of that option. The panel also wants a more thorough investigation of whether foreign governments are funding terror groups. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 100 points, or 1.2%, to close at 8,574 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 23 points, 1.7%, to close at 1,390. This is NPR News. Federal air safety investigators are blaming poor maintenance practices and inadequate government monitoring for the crash of an Alaska Airlines jetliner off the California coast 2 years ago. Although the pilots fought to keep the MD-80 aloft, the crash took the lives of all 88 people aboard the plane. The National Transportation Safety Board also said that improper lubrication on a tail fin component called a jack screw caused the part to fail. Alaska Airlines officials declined to comment on the report, saying they're still reviewing the findings. Nearly 340,000 North Carolina homes are still without electricity 6 days after an ice storm snapped power lines across the region. Brent Wolf reports from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill.
Utility crews from up and down the East Coast have restored electric service to 1 million North Carolina customers since Thursday. Only a few emergency shelters remain open, and most schools are back in session. Duke Power says it hopes to have electricity restored to 90% of its customers by Wednesday at midnight. Spokesman Tom Williams says the utility has been focusing on restoring service to large numbers of homes first.
And then we focus on the backyard outages that may have lines that go through backyards where there may just be a single line down between the power pole and the house. Those are the last that we get to simply because that would only affect one customer.
North Carolina Governor Mike Easley has asked President Bush to declare the state a federal disaster area. It could take months to clean up all the downed trees and branches. For NPR News, I'm Brent Wolf in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 12 points to close at 904. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pakistan is an important country in the war on terrorism, and its president, Pervez Musharraf, has pledged to be our ally. On the other hand, leaders of al-Qaeda are believed to be hiding out somewhere around the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Islamic extremists gained power in the recent election in Pakistan. My guest Owen Bennett-Jones reported from Pakistan for the BBC from 1998 to 2001. He's the author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. Pakistan was created as a Muslim state in 1947. Owen Bennett-Jones writes, ever since its creation, Pakistan's political development has been turbulent and chaotic. The country has been under military rule for nearly half its existence. No elected government has ever completed its term in office. It has had three wars with India and has lost around half of its territory. Nearly half its vast population is illiterate, and 20% is undernourished. I asked Owen Bennett-Jones if he thinks President Musharraf is a reliable ally in the war against terrorism.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that General Musharraf wants to support the United States. He took that decision immediately after September the 11th. He was faced with a pretty stark message from Washington. They said, back us or else. And he said, OK, it's got to be with America. Some of his generals didn't like it, but he sold that to them. He said, we have no choice in this. We have to back the United States and see what we can get from it. So he's been clear since then that he is backing the United States, but he has big domestic constraints. And I'm not sure that there is that much support for al-Qaeda in Pakistan, but certainly there is a vociferous minority who would be sympathetic with the objectives of al-Qaeda. And these are people who are well-armed, well-organized, and pretty violent. And so he's got to confront that. It's been a difficult year for him doing so, but there's no doubt he's committed to it.
In the recent elections, there were a few Islamic extremists who won. Would you explain the results of the recent election and how that changes the balance of power in the country?
Well, it's quite interesting this, because the coverage, I watched the coverage of the elections, and I'm afraid it sort of fell back into an old model of Western reporting on Islamic countries, where a lot of the headlines were about Islamic extremists poised to take over Pakistan and so on. The fact is that the hardline parties, the extremist religious parties, won 11% of the vote. Now, in the electoral system there, that did get translated into a much larger representation in the new parliament. But nonetheless, it gives you some indication, some context for what we're talking about here. I've maintained in the book that at the most, the support for the Islamic extremists in Pakistan is around 10-15%. And this election result is very much in line with that. And that's been the case throughout Pakistan's history. They've never done better than that. Now, this was a good result for them, no doubt. But 11% is not the whole country. It means 89% of the people in Pakistan did not vote for parties like that, despite the background of having many of their neighbours in Afghanistan bombed by the Americans. So you have to put this into context and to understand that Pakistan is not an extremist country. It is a place which, like many other Muslim countries, has a majority of the people who simply want to live their lives quietly, to be able to educate their children, to be able to get secure jobs and so on. And Pakistan's no different from many other countries in that respect.
Pakistan was created as a Muslim state. Is religious extremism fairly recent in Pakistan?
It's always been there, this strand of hardline religious thinking. But you have to ask why Pakistan was founded, actually. It's not entirely clear. It wasn't entirely clear at the time. There were those religious people who said it was founded, you know, to become an Islamic state. But I think more people, and indeed the leading figures of the Pakistan independence movement, like Jinnah and the others, were not after that. They were after a place where it would be safe for Muslims to live. And they did not feel it was safe in post-independence India. And they thought that the discrimination against the Muslims would be so intense that it would be quite intolerable. And that is why they demanded Pakistan. They didn't really see it as an Islamic state, but as a state where Muslims could live safely.
Was there a lot of tension between those who wanted it to be an Islamic state and those just wanted it, those who just wanted it to be a state where Islamics could live with freedom?
The tensions were always there, but they were in the background because the truth is the extremists have never had that big a number. They've never been strong enough to see off the majority. The difficulty with this is that the extremists have always been good at mobilizing demonstrations, what they call street power in Pakistan, and it's impressive. I mean, you know, you can get these parties can deliver a huge number of extremely angry-looking people onto the streets in a matter of hours. And governments in Pakistan have always been afraid of it. And, you know, one of the tragedies is that no one has been prepared to confront them. I mean, Musharraf, arguably, is the first leader in Pakistan to actually do it, to say, right, go to the streets, try your best and see how worried I am. And sure enough, after 2 or 3 months, it all petered out. And it did give an indication of how weak they are, and it was a sign that Musharraf was prepared, unlike most of his predecessors, to try to take them on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Owen Bennett-Jones. He's the author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. He covered Pakistan for the BBC from 1998 to 2001. Tell us a little bit about how General Zia-ul-Haq advanced the cause of radical Islam in Pakistan. First of all, what years did he rule Pakistan?
He governed from 1977, when he launched his military coup, right through to 1988, when he was killed in an air crash in extremely mysterious circumstances with the American ambassador to Pakistan at that time on board the plane at the same time. And he did have an agenda. He did have a very unidimensional, if you like, religious view of the world, and he tried to make Pakistan a more Islamic state. And there were lots of things he did, like appointing people to middle-ranking government jobs. These would be people drawn from the religious parties. He tried to make Ramadan more closely observed, more publicly observed, so that, you know, it became a criminal offence not to do that. And I think he did change the tone. But I think you have to remember that the whole Islamic world has been moving in this direction. Radical Islam is a much stronger force worldwide now than it was 20 years ago. General Zia certainly accelerated that process within Pakistan, and many Pakistanis very much resent that. They look back on his period as military ruler and think that that was the time when Pakistan's prospects really were dashed and when the chances of creating a modern, liberal, Islamic country informed by Muslim values but very much part of the world community, they think that was when all that unraveled.
One of the things he did was to Islamicize the military. How did he change the military?
He wanted an Islamic army. I think it's fair to say that. I mean, it's always difficult with him because he used this Islamic rhetoric. And, you know, he'd say, we are the soldiers of Allah and so on. But, you know, when it came down to the difficult decisions, you know, statecraft, I mean, for instance, I'll give you an example. When it came down to saying interest is un-Islamic and therefore we must not have it, that was his basic position. But when he saw that, you know, that meant IMF loans were out, World Bank loans were out, that Pakistan would basically have to drop out of the world financial system, yeah, he didn't do it. He still had a rational government mind in his head. He realized that it just wasn't possible to do that. I mean, Mullah Omar in Afghanistan more recently just said, fine, you know, the IMF can leave, the World Bank can leave. We are living how we want to. So General Zia was never like that. Within the army, it's the same story. He wanted to introduce Islamic precepts. He gave Islamic training to troops. He said that they must understand the Quran more fully, that they must try and implement the Quran. He asked his theorists, military theorists, to come up with things like Islamic codes of conduct in war, which he said were more humanitarian than the Red Cross codes that exist in the West, things like that. But when it came down to it, he still had basically a Western type army with Western equipment, which would be very familiar to generals from the United States or Britain.
You say that General Zia's successors, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, did little to dismantle his legacy. But then when Musharraf took over in a military coup in 1999, he tried to dismantle some of the Islamicization of the country that General Zia put into effect. What did he try to do?
Yeah, I mean, what you've got here is two military leaders who do have a very different vision. General Zia was, an Islamist. General Zia was a man with deep faith who wanted to make Pakistan a more Islamic society. So the kind of things he did, I mean, I've talked about the constraints he operated under, but the kind of things he did would be to make office workers pray five times a day, certainly government office workers, to try and make people live a more Islamic lifestyle. Now, General Musharraf is not interested in that. He says he's a man who believes, and I think we must take that at face value, but plainly he is not a strongly religious man, and he is interested in getting Pakistan's economy working when it comes to prayer time, for example. And some of his ADCs and military underlings come to him and say, "Sir, it's prayer time." If he's in the middle of a meeting, he just says, "Look, I've got business. I've got government business here. Prayers can wait." Now, General Zia would never have done that. It gives you some impression of the different approach of the two men. And to some extent, General Musharraf is trying to undo what General Zia did. He's trying to make religion less central in Pakistani life and to get the economy working, to get Pakistan more part of the international community.
What has Musharraf accomplished in Pakistan compared to what he promised he would accomplish when he took over in a military coup?
Not a whole lot. I mean, my view is that he's a man who knows what he wants to do. He wants to make Pakistan a secular liberal state, but he's not able to do it. He hasn't shown much sign of having the political will or ability to force his agenda through. He's said, for instance, that he wants to raise more income tax. Now, if you look at it, it's an incredible fact that Pakistan's government raises hardly any income tax. 1% of Pakistanis pay income tax. This is a nuclear state with a massive need for public spending on welfare programs. Only 1% pay tax. Now, he saw this and said, it's hopeless. We've got to change that. He had this big drive to raise more tax. And I can tell you, if you go to the Central Board of Revenue, the people in charge of collecting the money now, they'll tell you it's not much better than it was when he took over. He hasn't managed to do it, despite having a big political fight over it. You know, there were strikes against him when he tried to impose a tax survey, but it hasn't actually happened. And it's a good example because it shows you just how difficult it is to govern Pakistan. There is no administration for him to rely on. The people in the ministries just don't do anything. If you go and see the ministers, they're all talking about, personal deals they can do for plots of land and all the rest of it. They're not actually working. They're all very free to see journalists because they've got nothing else to do. And so it's a very difficult country to govern. And he, I think, is failing to do it. I mean, it's a great shame because he does know what he wants to do and he is a military man. So if anyone's going to be able to, that's the whole point of having a military coup. If you're going to do it, you might as well have some strong government and impose some pretty basic reforms. You know, he's not managed to do it. And it's a great disappointment to a lot of Pakistanis.
Now, you said that President Musharraf wants a secular state, yet he supported the Taliban in Afghanistan. Why did he support them?
He just saw it as within Pakistan's national interest. He thought that if he had a government which was basically, those guys who ran the Taliban had all been educated in northern Pakistan. They all knew Pakistan very well. They had very good relations with Islamabad. And his idea was, if they're there, that's fine. We will never face any instability on that border, and we can concentrate all our military resources on the border with India in case India attacks. So he called it strategic depth, and it was a misguided policy. Everyone realized at the time, and not everyone, the senior officers all thought it was great. Most of the people in Pakistan, the intellectuals in Pakistan, realized it was a crazy idea because the Islamic fundamentalism was bound to seep across the border and to infect Pakistan itself, which is exactly what the army doesn't want. So it was a short-sighted policy, but there were reasons for it. And I remember tackling him on the issue, before September the 11th, saying, what on earth are you doing supporting these people? And he'd just say, look, we've always, there were ethnic elements to it as well. He said, we've always supported a Pashtun government in Afghanistan. It is strategic depth for us. We've got to have only one frontier. We're worried about the Indian frontier. We can't afford and spread our resources over two. And that was the basis of his thinking.
My guest is journalist Owen Bennett Jones. His new book is called Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Owen Bennett Jones. He's the author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. And he reported on Pakistan for the BBC from 1998 to 2001. Have you met Musharraf? And if so, what are your personal impressions of him?
Yeah, I met him a few times. He's I'll tell you what he's like, in my view. He's like the sort of guy you meet in a golf club who will sit there over the bar, you know, or in the mess room, in the officer's mess, and sit there and say, you know, it's perfectly obvious what we've got to do to this country. You know, all you got to do is put the corrupt people in jail and it'll be fine. And this is what these guys did, these generals. They sit there moaning about the civilian governments in much the same way as people moan about the governments, you know, as they sit around their golf club bar. And then, you know, he got presented with the extraordinary situation where he was actually in power. And he's discovered it's not that easy. And the whole anti-corruption thing, you know, which he was very hot on in the first few weeks, has gone away. And half of his military colleagues are corrupt anyway. And, you know, when it comes down to it, he doesn't want to put them in jail. So he has faced up to the realities of office, and it hasn't been easy for him. I mean, there are lots of good things about him. He's an honest man. And, I mean, I'll give you an example of that. I was actually, you know, the first few weeks when he took over, whenever he wanted to put on his sort of nice, friendly sort of image, he'd wear a civilian suit rather than his military uniform. And I noticed it's always the same suit. And I said to one of his guys, I said, he always wears the same suit, this bloke. And he went, yeah, it's his wedding suit. That was the only suit he had. He was the chief of the Pakistan army. And he only had one civilian suit. This is not a corrupt individual. He's now got a few more. I to try to find out who paid for them. I suspect the government, but probably they said they needed more suits to, you know, handle foreign trips and so on. So my impression is that he's basically a man who many Western politicians could relate to. He is the moderate face of Islam. He is, in that sense, the mainstream of Islam. But does he have the political skill to push all this through? I don't think so.
What does the United States want from Pakistan as an ally in the war against terrorism?
Well, it wants support, logistical support for going into Afghanistan. And I guess now it wants Pakistani cooperation in mopping up Islamic militants in Pakistan. And it's doing it in a pretty crude way. I mean, you know, if the Americans get information that there are some militants holed up somewhere, they now don't even tell the Pakistani police until about 2 hours before the operation for fear that someone will tip those people off and they'll get away. And it's caused a lot of resentment in Pakistan. I mean, you can see both sides of it. I mean, the Americans may well be right that that is what would happen. But, of course, within Pakistan, you've got General Musharraf's critics saying, what on earth is this? We've got a military government who are allowing the Americans to conduct police operations on Pakistani soil. It's a satellite of the United States. We don't even have any self-respect anymore. So the Americans are doing that, and I guess that's the most important thing that Musharraf can offer him, because I'm sure maybe even bin Laden, you know, he may be in Pakistan, and if the Pakistani authorities are able to cooperate on finding those people, then that's very much what the Americans would be after.
What's your best guess, if you have any, about how much of Al-Qaeda is hiding out now in Pakistan?
Well, I wonder how many there are left, you know. I mean, how many were there in the first place? I asked some diplomats, a lot of diplomats in Islamabad, you know, September the 10th, what were your estimates for Al-Qaeda? The highest number I got was 1,700. Now, when you think what's happened since then, many of them have been killed. Many of them have fled, will be with their mums holding out somewhere trying to keep a low profile, probably forget the whole thing and move on to having a regular job or something. And there'll be a few left, a few hundred left, and some of those will be in Pakistan. But I don't think there's any getting away from the fact that the Americans have won that war against Al-Qaeda. One wonders what they're doing in Afghanistan now. And, of course, this doesn't mean there won't be further attacks, because, you know, how many people does it take to organise the kind of attack that happened to you on September the 11th? You know, a dozen, something like that. It doesn't take many people. But as an organisation, I think, you know, it is very, very much weaker than it was a year ago.
I've heard a lot that they've regrouped, that they're maybe as strong as ever. And, I mean, the head of the CIA in the United States said that there's as much kind of chatter now as there was, you know, that they're picking up as there was before September 11th. And he thinks we're as in grave danger now as we were then. So it sounds like in that respect, we haven't done such an effective job yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously these people have an interest in saying that. I'm not so convinced. I mean, it's always a very difficult argument to pursue this, because it isn't to say there can't be further attacks, you know, nor is it to say that there aren't a lot of people who would sympathise with Al-Qaeda. And, you know, I mean, we've seen attacks...
And become freelancers.
We've seen attacks in Indonesia, in the Philippines. I mean, these people are active. But look at it this way. If you were sitting at the top of Al-Qaeda and you thought that September the 11th was a great success, and since then you've been taking a massive number of hits, you've been attacked by the United States and the world community since then, you would want to respond. What have they done? They've not been able to organise anything of significance. None of the sort of projects they'd like to pull off have they been able to do. Now, you can say that, you know, they may be able to do so in the future, and you can't rule it out, but that must give you some indication of how weak they are. But they've not been able to launch another major attack on the West, and I can assure you that's exactly what they want to do.
But just take what happened in Kenya. You know, the shooting down of an Israeli plane, well, the near shooting down, the attempt to shoot down an Israeli plane with, you know, a shoulder-launched missile, that's a kind of, like, new breakthrough in terrorist tactics. That hasn't been done before to a passenger plane. And then, you know, the bombing of the hotel in Kenya, the bombing in Bali. I mean, these are...
Yes, I know.
It's not the World Trade Center, but it's pretty significant.
Well, of course it is. If you're involved in it, it's absolutely terrifying and horrible. But you must appreciate that that is not their top-line target. I mean, their top-line target are prestige targets in the West. If you were looking at it from the Al-Qaeda point of view, you'd be sitting there saying, is this the best we can do, Mombasa and Bali? This is not what they want to do. They want to do, you know, the Houses of Westminster, Congress, big towers in America. And they don't have the capacity to do it. Now, I mean, as I keep saying, it's a very sort of dodgy thing to say, because they may be able to do it one day. But, you know, so far they haven't. And, you know, they want to. And that is an indication, you look at it both ways, of the weakness of Al-Qaeda or the strength of the Western intelligence agencies, which are preventing them from doing these things.
Owen Bennett-Jones is the author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by WorldCom, a summary of progress in finances, service, and business practices, and a look forward, available at worldcom.com/update. And by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pakistan's nuclear bomb. We continue our conversation with journalist Owen Bennett-Jones, author of Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. And we meet Brazilian songwriter Caetano Veloso, one of the founders of Tropicália. His memoir has just been published in English, and he has a new CD. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Owen Bennett Jones, author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. He reported on Pakistan for the BBC from 1998 to 2001. Pakistan has a nuclear bomb, and it's the only Muslim state with a nuclear bomb. What are their safety mechanisms for controlling it?
Who knows? They won't tell us. I've tried to find out, and I've not got any indication. And I've asked people at this end what their impression is, people who might know, and they don't have much idea either. You know, do they have? It's quite worrying, I think. They insist that they're fine, that they've got excellent command and control features and so on. But, you know, the difficulty with it is that the number of minutes, I forget what it exactly is, it's something like 7 minutes or something, or even less, that a bomb launched by India would land in Pakistan and vice versa. There is very, very little reaction time. And in those circumstances, what would happen? And my fear is that what they've done is devolved, and I've got some reason for saying this, I mean, it's difficult to confirm it, but devolved the authority over the use of these nuclear weapons to quite a low level in the army, brigadier level, because they know that if their top leadership was hit, that they'd have to have some kind of system of dispersing authority. So if that's the case, then, you know, that is bad news, and you would have to worry about accidental accidental use or use without due authority. And it's a worrying situation.
Well, here's something else. Since there's a history of coups in Pakistan, are there fears that there could be an Islamic extremist coup and that Islamic extremists could then control a nuclear bomb?
Through a coup, I doubt it, because if you look at it, there was an attempt to do that before when Benazir Bhutto was in charge, and it failed. And there's never been an internal coup in the army that's worked. You know, I mean, the army's taken over from civilian governments, but never has an army leader himself been removed from office in an internal coup or putsch. So the history is that the Pakistan army, which is a well-disciplined organisation, is basically able to keep a control on this, and that whenever anyone's tried to do it, they've failed. And I think there's good reason to believe that that would be the case. If you look further ahead and say, look, Pakistan is a country where people are hungry, where the government institutions have failed, which they have, where no one gets, or very few people, get justice from the courts, where the police are corrupt and incompetent, where the state just isn't delivering basic services to its people. Now, if you look at that in the long term and say, if all these civilian and military governments fail, which they are doing, one day, surely, someone will say, give the Islamists a chance. They've got an agenda. They've got a view. They have hopes that they can sort this country out. Give them a go. And I don't rule that out. And I mean, you can't put a time on it, 10, 20 years. I mean, I think it's quite possible within 20 years that there'll be a strong Islamic government in Pakistan. As I say, not really through the army. I think probably maybe through elections. You know, the support for the Islamic parties could build because everyone else is messing it up. And if that were the case, then sure, you would begin to wonder what is going to happen to the nuclear arsenal. Now, there are a lot of ifs in all that. But nonetheless, it is, I think, a not totally unrealistic scenario.
Now, knowing the region as well as you do, do you think that the United States or that a larger coalition should go to war with Iraq?
It's a difficult issue. I mean, I can hear a lot of the arguments against, some of which I find more convincing than others. It seems to me the most compelling argument against is that it is preemptive military action. And that does cross a line. And you have to ask, if Saddam Hussein has these weapons, is he going to use them? And of course, you know, there are people who will say he's used them before, he could do so again. That's clearly true. But if you say that it is enough that he possesses them to attack him, then, you know, that does set a new benchmark in international politics. And we look at North Korea, who apparently do have a nuclear weapon. We look at Iran, who certainly want one. Various other countries who are working on chemical and biological weapons, if not nuclear. And you wonder where this all leads and whether it is then okay to attack them as well. So I mean, to my mind, that is the fundamental issue at the bottom of all this. I don't think all the arguments about, well, we, you know, always turned a blind eye to them in the past and various other arguments that are deployed, you know, all the whole of the Middle East will unravel. I'm not so convinced by all that, but I do think that this question of preemptive military action is pretty fundamental and deserves pretty serious thought before one gets involved in it.
Well, how do you think a war with Iraq would affect the region? Do you think the whole region would be completely changed in ways that we can't even imagine?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, it's almost certainly going to happen, so I guess we'll find out. I mean, last time round, the big question was whether Israel would respond to an attack, and Israel was persuaded not to. Clearly, if Israel did attack, then the whole situation does change. I mean, America's obviously aware of that and will be doing everything it can to prevent Israel getting directly involved. But, you know, it all depends whether Israel is hit hard. And if it is hit hard, presumably it would feel it has to respond. And I guess the other long-term issue is Kurdistan. And I do find it slightly odd that, you know, the Kurds quite plainly want independence. I mean, you know, surely nobody doubts that. And yet it seems that Western politicians are happy to take their assurances that they want greater autonomy within Iraq at face value. Now, that's just not believable. And if it is that Iraq is hit hard and the Kurds see a chance to advance their claims to independence, then that would change the world in that part of the world because, you know, there are a lot of other countries involved then, not least Turkey, who have Kurds there too. So you would wonder about that issue. So, I mean, there are question marks. But, I mean, I am also aware that, you know, I'm sure people in the administration, your administration would say, whenever we talk about these kind of big military actions, there's always people who make drastic predictions about what's going to happen, and they don't often come true. And I think there's some truth in that, that has happened in the past, that people have made very dire predictions which haven't come to pass. You know, we'll find out, I guess.
Well, Owen Bennett-Jones, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Owen Bennett-Jones is the author of the new book, Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. Coming up, Brazilian singer and songwriter Caetano Veloso, one of the originators of the music known as Tropicália. This is Fresh Air. Composer and singer Caetano Veloso is a star in Brazil and has quite a following in the U.S. Along with Gilberto Gil, Veloso is one of the originators of the music known as Tropicália or Tropicalismo. This music came on the heels of bossa nova in the late 60s and combined Brazilian traditions with rock, pop, and avant-garde poetry and embraced elements of 60s counterculture. Many of Veloso's fellow college students condemned the music for commercializing Brazilian sounds. The Brazilian military dictatorship hated the freedom the music represented. Veloso and Gil were imprisoned for several weeks in 1968. Veloso's memoir, Tropical Truth, A Story of Music and Revolution in Brazil, has just been published in English. His music is on the soundtrack of Pedro Almodovar's new film, and Veloso has a new CD called Live from Bahia. Let's start with a track from it called Menino do Rio, The Boy from Rio.
Menino do Rio. Calor que provoca arrepio, dragão tatuado no braço, calção, corpo aberto no espaço, coração de eterno flerte, adoro ver-te, menino vadio, tensão flutuante do rio, eu canto pra Deus proteger-te. O Havaí, seja aqui, tudo que sonhar, todos os lugares, as ondas dos mares, pois quando eu te vejo, eu desejo teu desejo.
Thank you. Caetano Veloso was born in 1942. When he was 17, he heard Brazilian songwriter João Gilberto, one of the originators of the bossa nova. In his memoir, Veloso describes Gilberto as his supreme master. I asked Veloso to describe the impact Gilberto's music had on him.
I was living in Santo Amaro, my little hometown, and I was at high school, and when I heard it for the first time, I thought that a new world was opening before me, a new world of songs, a new world of sensibility, a new world of possibilities, and also of responsibilities. I was 17, but I understood that what João Gilberto was doing to samba, to the Brazilian tradition of popular music, was really illuminating the past and opening new tasks for the future. And I still try to live up to it.
Now, you were one of the people who took music in a slightly different direction, something that's been called tropicalia or tropicalismo. Forgive my pronunciations.
It's perfect now.
So where did you differ? What did you want in your music that was kind of frowned on?
What we did was different because we didn't want to be defensive in that nationalistic fashion that everybody was following, you know. We, in fact, faced opposition from the left. Left-wing students would be hostile to everything we did in 1967 through 68, and because we accepted international influences, we considered that the presence of American mass culture was something that was part of our lives and that we should be able to express ourselves using some procedures that we learned from rock and roll and American pop culture. And on the other hand, we didn't think that the traditional protest song was our better vehicle to express what we felt under a dictatorship and in those times of counterculture.
So if you heard the Beatles or Ray Charles, you weren't going to just see that as imperialistic influences from England or America. You're going to see that as good music, and if that influenced you, fine.
Well, yeah. You know, it's true. But, you know, even the Beatles, in our view, even then, they were an example that mass culture could be healthy, could be a healthy influence. You know, we had noticed that because before that we were not, my group of friends, we were not interested in rock and roll. It was just, you know, things, rock and roll was something that we could hear on the radio. We could even learn how to sing short lyrics and, you know, but we didn't think it was an important thing in any way. It was just commercial rubbish, you know. But what the Beatles did, they made a shift in considering the status of rock and roll. And we ourselves wanted to do the same in Brazil.
I'm wondering if there's a song on your new live CD that is a song that you wrote in the 60s and were doing during the period that we're talking about now.
The song Tropicália itself, isn't it? I think it's representative of the period. In fact, it's an emblem of the period.
In what sense?
Because this song, Tropicália, gave name to the movement. From its title, the name of the movement was born. And it is a song that says, that portrays Brazil in a strange way. It's an allegoric portrait of Brazil with violent images, and it's a little bit like a cubist painting because it's seen from different angles and from different perspectives.
Why don't I just read a little bit of the English translation before we hear the recording? Above my head, the aeroplanes, under my feet, the trucks and trains. My nose in profile against the highland plains. I organize the movement. I lead the carnival. I inaugurate the monument on the central plateau of the nation. Long live Bossa Nova. Long live Paloca. The monument is silver crepe paper, the green eyes of the mulatta. In the green forest, her hair veils the backland's moonlight. The monument has no door. The entrance is an old, narrow, winding road, etc.
Well, and then comes the image of a dead child that I don't remember. It's a very, if you read just two
more
lines.
And on its knee, a smiling, ugly, dead child holds out its hand. Long live the matata, long live the mulata, and so on.
So some, you know, really some violent images, and it's a celebration of Brazil. But it's a sinister celebration, you know. It's a parody of a celebration. But on the other hand, it celebrates Brazil, in fact, although it recognizes its violence, injustice, and somber moments, because we were then under dictatorship, and I wanted to express the deepest feelings that arose in those circumstances.
My guest is Brazilian singer, songwriter, and guitarist Caetano Veloso. Here's his 1967 recording of Tropicália.
Sobre a cabeça os aviões, sobre os meus pés os caminhões, aponta contra os chapadões meu nariz. Eu organizo o movimento, eu oriento o carnaval, eu inauguro o monumento no planalto central do país. Viva a bossa, sassá, viva a palhoça, sassá, sassá. Viva a bossa, sassá, viva a palhoça, sassá, sassá. Monumento de papel, crepô e prata, os olhos verdes da mulata, a cabeleira esconde atrás da verde mata, o luar do sertão. O monumento não tem porta, a entrada é uma rua antiga, estreita e torta, e no joelho uma criança sorridente, feia e morta, estende a mão. Viva a mata, tá, tá, viva a mulata, tá, 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 tá. Viva a mata, tá, tá. Viva a mulata, tá, 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 tá.
Caetano Veloso will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brazilian songwriter and singer Caetano Veloso, one of the originators of the music known as Tropicália or Tropicalismo. He was imprisoned by Brazil's military dictatorship for several weeks. You write in your new book, Tropical Truth, that when you were arrested in 1968 by the military government, You didn't expect that anything really bad was going to happen to you. You say, we were so used to the hostilities of the left, so often accused of being alienated and Americanized, that when you saw yourself before the policeman, you imagined they were going to take you to talk to some official who would treat you like your average young guy who's only interested in amusing the public, your average entertainer. So you really weren't prepared for being arrested, for put in solitary confinement, for being beaten, all the things that you were actually exposed to.
No, we weren't. We didn't expect, and we were not prepared. Mostly me. I wasn't. I almost went crazy, you know. It was really hard. But it's true. We were not prepared to that. Because, as I told you, left-wing students would react against our music, so we thought that the military would not think of us as being, you know,
a threat. So, why do you think the military did see you as a threat? What were they afraid of with your music?
There were people within the military that knew and understood the connections between what we were doing. And, for example, May 68 in Paris, or American protest against Vietnam War, and, you know, the California things. Some people knew. Some of the military guys knew that what we were doing might mean some kind of new left, you know, a different kind of left. We ourselves thought of what we were doing as being some kind of new left, in a way. And the authorities were kind of advised by some who knew that what we were doing was somehow, you know, dangerous, because it could be could destabilize the psychology of the youth, you know. It could damage their values, you know. Some of them knew.
It's interesting that during this time in the 60s, when music becomes so politically charged in Brazil, and when you and others are arrested because of your music, in America, what's mostly known about Brazilian music in the 60s is the samba, which is considered to be a very kind of gentle, relaxing music with lyrics about love and beauty and, you know, gentle waves on the ocean and things like that. So what did you think then of the American understanding of what Brazilian music was?
Well, it was mostly bossa nova. You know, bossa nova was something that happened in the 50s in Brazil, 1958. João Gilberto recorded his first single. So, and in 59 it was like established in Brazil. So in the mid-60s, everybody in the United States knew Sérgio Mendes better than anything else from Brazil. Apart from João Gilberto and Astrud Gilberto singing The Girl from Ipanema, but that was delayed to what was happening in Brazil, you know? And, well, after that, even those people who started writing bossa nova with predominantly love songs, they started writing protest songs. You know, the very most important lyricist of bossa nova, Vinícius de Moraes, who was a poet, he was the first modern protest songwriter in Brazil, you know. He started writing protest songs in the early 60s, and so did Carlos Lira and some other people who were the pioneers of bossa nova, you know. But these Brazilian protest songs would sound to any American ear as sweet as any other love song, you know,
because we wouldn't understand the lyric.
because you don't understand the lyric and because Brazilian music tends to sound sweet in any way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they already, you know, had entire albums of just protest songs, you know. Samba as being the basic rhythm, but the words would be a protest against social injustice and against dictatorship, although not explicitly saying things about the dictatorship, but it was obviously against it. And things that were said both about against a social injustice and suggestions of revolution or change in society, these things were clearly explicit in the lyrics of the songs of that time, of that period.
Now, how would you compare the kind of music that you're writing and performing now with what you were doing in the 60s in Brazil when your music was so controversial?
I don't know if I'm able to compare what I do now to what I used to do then. But I'd say nowadays I know better. Like, I can make things in a better way. Things are better done. This is for sure. Better recorded, better tuning, better everything. But on the other hand, I was younger.
Caetano Veloso, he has a new CD called Live from Bahia. His memoir, Tropical Truth, has just been published in English. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another song from Caetano Veloso's new CD.
Menino Deus, corpo azul dourado. Porto Alegre é bem mais que seguro na rota das nossas viagens no escuro. Menino Deus, quando tua luz se acenda, a minha voz comporá tua lenda e por momento haverá mais futuro do que jamais houve. Mas ouve a nossa harmonia, a eletricidade ligada no dia em que brilharias por sobre a cidade. Menino Deus, quando a flor do teu sexo abrir as pétalas para o universo, então por lapso se encontrar anexo, ligando os breus, dando sentido aos mundos e aos corações.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House, and Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides. Providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the controversial formula that was created to financially compensate the families of September 11th victims. We talk with Lisa Belkin, who wrote about the Victim Compensation Fund for the New York Times Magazine. We'll also talk about her Times column, which covers the intersection of life and work. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.